People, welcome back to Rebranding Safety. This is episode 18, how to do a fire risk assessment. Today I'm going to tell you the truth about fire risk assessments. I'm going to tell you what you need to know, what you need to look for, and essentially the basics on how to do them yourselves. If you don't want to do them yourself, then still listen to the end, where we'll tell you how to find good consultants, the tips and tricks of what to look out for to make sure they're telling you the truth. All of this to enable you to stay safe and cost effective. Let's get into the podcast.
Health and safety is almost a victim of its own success.
Weird and oppressive regime of health and safety regulations.
A huge fire engulfs a tower block in London.
Children being forced to wear goggles to play conkers at school.
Worst oil field disaster, 164 dead.
Rebranding Safety, the modern health and safety podcast, crushing the stereotype. Brought to you by Risk Fluent and your host, James McPherson. So welcome back, people. So like I said, this is episode 18. This week it's just me on my Todd. We're talking about fire risk assessments. So let's get into it then. So we've done a podcast on the regulatory reform order, which was episode 19. So in there, that tells us who's responsible. So the regulatory reform fire safety order is the primary piece of legislation for fire safety. So in there, like I just said, tells you who the responsible person is for fire safety. So basically, if you're an employer, the owner of the property, you know, the landlord, occupier, you know, anyone in control of the premises, for example, like a facilities manager, building manager, anything like that, you're known as the responsible person. There might be more than one responsible person, in which case, there is, and I can't remember the article off the top of my head, but there's an article in there around cooperation and coordination. So you've got to work together on that. So it also applies if you have paying guests. For example, if you run a bed and breakfast or a guest house or self-catering property like that. So you may be the responsible person. First thing to do, find out if you are. If you are the responsible person, you need a fire risk assessment. Hence this podcast. So the responsible person must carry out a fire risk assessment, tell staff or their representative about the risks that they've identified, put in place, maintain appropriate fire safety messages. Well, technically true, you do need to provide information, instruction and training, but I actually meant to say fire safety measures. Fire safety measures. Just a slight side note, the reason I roll with these mistakes is so that I don't have to edit them out, because it's an absolute pain in the ass, because I actually mess up so much that I actually spend all the time just editing. So I roll with as many mistakes as I can, but I do edit out and it's probably double. Shouldn't really tell you that, should I? Anyway, moving on. So, appropriate fire safety measures. Put in place and maintain appropriate fire safety measures. There we go. Move on from that point. Not saying again. That is it. End of point. Plan for emergencies. And then finally, provide information, instruction, and training around fire safety, and try to provide it in a clearer, more concise way to this podcast, which this is not. Anyway, non-domestic premises then. So non-domestic premises, we spoke about them and the regulatory reform order as well. So, you know, if you listen to this and you think, yeah, this is me, this applies to me, I need to do a fire risk assessment, go check out episode 14, because I'll tell you everything you need to know around the law. So let's get into fire risk assessments then. So the basics of a fire risk assessment is not much different to a normal risk assessment. We've got to identify the fire hazard, identify people at risk, then evaluate, remove and reduce the risk, record your findings, prepare an emergency plan, provide training, review and an update and update the fire risk assessment regularly. It's basically the same. We got to identify hazards, identify people at risk, evaluate the risk, remove risk and try and reduce risk. Yeah, if we can't do that, we control the risk. Then in the guidance, it adds on the bits about recording your findings, prepare an emergency plan and then provide training. So we've got to do the assessment, then we've got to provide some training. So let's break these down then. So identify the hazards. Well, the basics of hazards is going to, what you need to know first really is the fire triangle. So if you all imagine a triangle, if you will, and if you can see through the audio, you will see that I'm actually making a triangle with my hands. So you can see me making this triangle, and on one side of the triangle we have oxygen, and then we have fuel and heat. They make up three sides of the triangle. So without one of those, so we remove oxygen, without that the fire cannot continue. Yeah, so most of us know that. And we remove fuel, but we put oxygen back, and it can't continue. It will go down. Doesn't mean it's extinguished, but we're not going to go into that. It's too, way too technical. But we remove one of them, the fire's gone. So we're trying to identify where we can have that kind of ingredients of a fire. You know, it's a chemical reaction of fire. It's where a thing, something is heated up so much that it vaporizes, and then we get flames. So if you actually look at a match, interesting fact, if you look at a match, and let's say if we would slice that match in half, you'd be able to see that around the head of the match, the flames don't actually touch the match head. There's like this clear gap. Don't look too close because you might not have any eyebrows, and I don't want to get sued tomorrow. You know, rebranding safety told me to look at closely at a match, and I've got no eyebrows left. But try and look at the match, and you'll be able to see that there's a clear kind of film around the head of the match. That's where it's vaporizing, it's producing vapor, and it's the vapor that's igniting. Interesting fact, there you go, one for your pub quiz. So we're going to try and identify where we've got oxygen, which is obviously everywhere, fuel and heat. So they're the two that we can control. Yeah, we can't remove oxygen really without us dying. So we tried to separate fuel and heat. So we're trying to do that. We're trying to identify where they're together. Let's say we can't do that. One of the other things we're going to look at is how the fire might spread. So things we're going to consider here. Four main types of spread. These are things you've got to consider. So we've got conduction. So conduction is a transmission of heat through materials. So if you think about your cooker, your frying pan on the side, yes, you've got conduction. So the flames are heating the pan, and then the heat is conducting through that metal. Yeah, so where might you get that in work? I mean, things like steel girders, things like that, where the heat can transport through the building via the heat conducting in those girders. Yeah, radiation is a transmission by heat waves that are traveling until the heat is absorbed by other objects. An example of this would be like a bar heater, an open fireplace radiating onto a drying rack, or like a curtain or something like that. Yeah, so sometimes when we see like a flashover where the room is heated up so much, the heat is radiating off these, say like a sofa in a room, that they've got to the point where they're vaporizing so much that they combust, they spontaneously combust. Yeah, so that, if I remember rightly, that's a flashover. Then we've got direct burning as well. So it's the simplest way that a fire can spread is basically a direct application from flame to item. So match to paper. Yeah, simple form. So what we're trying to do then is trying to stop those things happening. So we're trying to stop obviously the three points of the fire triangle, but then combine that with those methods of spread, boom, we've got a pretty bad fire. So we're trying to reduce the chances of that. Things like compartmentation will help us here. So compartmentation is quite common in the news at the moment around the obvious issues that we've had and obvious tragic events that we've had. So in a block of flats is a great example of how compartmentation should work, because ideally a flat would be a 60-minute compartment. So that means a 60-minute box that will resist fire for 60 minutes. Yeah, so the fire can start in this flat and it's not going anywhere for 60 minutes. Normal work places where might, God, I can't get my words out today. I say this every week. In normal workplaces, where might we get something like that? Well, in say like a block of offices, you're going to have like a protected staircase. That'll be why you've got fire doors around the staircase. You might have quite a big wide open staircase, maybe with some offices coming off of like the landing. That's fine. You've just got to have fire doors off of those things, yeah, because it's a protected staircase. So that'll be like a 60 minute protected staircase, and you'll have probably 30 minute or 60 minute fire doors on there, depending on the design of the building. So why would you put 30 minute fire doors? Well, again, flats are a great example there. So you only have a 30 minute fire door on a block of flats. Well, why is that? Because it's supposed to be a 60 minute box? Yes, that's a great question, James. Thanks, James. No worries, James. Anyway, moving on. You only have a 30 minute fire door, primarily because 60 minute fire doors are heavy as fuck. But it's because you would have a 30 minute fire door on one flat and a 30 minute fire door on the next flat. Therefore, 30 plus 30, my maths is bad, but I think that makes 60. Boom, we've got 60 minute compartmentation. So that's the basics of compartmentation. What other things have we got to consider when we're talking about fire spread is housekeeping. Housekeeping is a massive, massive contributor to fire spread. If we look at the Bradford Football Stadium fire, you know, that whole thing was made because of the terrible housekeeping that there was. So you imagine, if you know it, great. If you don't, I'll just go through it quickly. So if you imagine, like, kind of, I always refer to them as like the American football stadium seats, you know, where they're just like wooden planks essentially that you sit on, and you would put your legs on one in front of you, and there's just loads and loads of them all stacked up, nothing underneath them. Well, that's what the setup was at this football stadium. Well, what happened there is that everyone has, you know, their chips and all that, the newspaper just kind of dropped on the floor, and that built up over years and years and years. Somebody had a fag, because you could smoke in the stadiums back then, had the puff, finished it, they went to stand on it, on the wooden seat, on the wooden foot rest, and it fell into the paper. Up it goes, it's a wooden stadium that was due to be demolished, and the whole thing goes horrendous fire. You can actually get a really not good video, but it is a good video from a point of view of being able to use it for training and stuff. When I say good video, that's what I mean. And it's also quite interesting to see how people react in fire, because they're all pissed off the head. But yeah, that's kind of how that happened, and housekeeping was a massive contributory factor to that. Other things we've got to consider, you know, the kind of the maintenance and of the ceilings and the walls and stuff like that. You know, it sounds really, really stupid, but if we go a bit OTT on, you know, posters and stuff like that all along the wall, then things are going to get out of hand, and it's going to be real, real simple for that fire to spread. Consider things like wallpaper and stuff. I'm not saying go over the top and buy incandescent wallpaper, or don't put any posters on the wall. I'm saying just be sensible about this stuff. Yeah, schools can be quite bad at it. They want to display everybody's posters. You know, and you go there and you think, Jesus Christ, this is an escape route, and there's paper absolutely everywhere. So just think about it sensibly. I'm not saying go over the top. Just think about it cleverly. If you do own a building, we're talking about compartmentation again, but if you do own a building, you know, think about contractors you're having coming in, and they're drilling holes through walls and they're breaching your compartmentation. Anyway, we're not really teaching you how to do a fire assessment, are we? These are all things essentially that you've got to look at when you're thinking about fire assessment. But most of you are just going to have real simple buildings. So we're just talking about how a fire starts. So we need to control the combination of fuel and heat. Then we've done that. Now we're going to look at, let's just assume that a fire started. We're going to think, how can this fire spread from here? What areas have we got to protect? Well, the area we've got to protect is escape routes. They're the most important bit, because most of your buildings are going to be an evacuation, a simultaneous evacuation, as we should call it. They're not going to be stay put. You might have a couple of phased evacuation, and you might have a couple of like progressive horizontals maybe. So just to quickly go through them, phased would be, let's say for example, you've got like a collection of buildings set up kind of like dominoes. Building one has a fire in it, you might get building two that's connected to that. the alarm would go off in building one and two because they're joined to each other. And then building three would have like a pre-alarm, just warning everybody that there is a fire in building two and one. So do not leave building three. But potentially it might spread and we might evacuate the whole building. So these can all get overcomplicated a bit in depth, but that's what they are. A progressive horizontal, commonly used in hospitals, things like that, where they would move the patients around the building away from the fire and eventually evacuate. Anyway, we're digressing again. Maybe you can't do fire assessments yourself because, you know, I've obviously overcomplicated this and we've only been going 14 minutes. Anyway, so let's get back to the point. Emergency escape route set. Let's keep it simple, James. That's the whole point of this podcast. So you want to have you're going to have some nice, clean, sterile escape routes within reason. Okay, don't go crazy. Like I said, you can have a couple of posters on there. You know, don't go in there and be like, oh my God, you can't even put the fire action notice in there because it's got to be sterile. Like, for God's sake, just calm down. Consider with escape routes is the building being used what it's designed to be used for? So if you're in a block of offices and it was designed to be a block of offices, then great. What that means then is that the escape routes are going to be designed for the give or take for the amount of people that are in that building. So the minimum width for escape route should ideally be is 1,050 mil, but in any case not less than 750 mil. 750 mil can accommodate up to 80 people in high risk properties, 100 in normal risk properties, 120 in low risk. Yeah, so that's what your building will most probably be designed to if it's being used for what it was designed for. So where we might get a little bit complicated is where you've got, say, like a Victorian terrace house that's been converted into offices. Yeah. You're not going to get escape routes that are made for a shed load of people. So just bear in mind how many people you're putting there. If you're only putting, you know, using each room's got like two people in it upstairs and then you've got like five or six people downstairs, we're still talking pretty low risk. Doesn't mean you can't do that. No, it doesn't. What it means is you might have to go a bit over the top on the other things. So like the removal of heat and fuel together and stuff like that. And that's what a point of a risk assessment is. You know, it's not a go in there and we've got to do everything it says in the guidance. It's to go in there and assess the risk. You've still got to run your business at the same time. You've still got to make money. And that's a point of risk assessment. So think about the design of the building. Think about how you're using that building. With escape routes, we've also got travel distances as well. Now, really, we're only talking big buildings here where it's going to start being a bit of a pain. So, again, it probably won't be a pain if you're using a building for what it is designed for. But in case, you can find all of these travel distances and widths of escape routes in guidance. You know, it's real simple stuff. Everything's out there for you. The only complicated bit that can be sometimes is finding the right guidance for you. But to be honest, most of your buildings or your operations or undertakings, whatever you want to call them, it'd be pretty simple for you to be able to pick out which one. It's when we start getting into like housing and complicated operations where it really starts to get a little bit complicated. So there are complicated things around travel distances and widths, but ultimately an escape route's just got to be easy to access, safe, immediately usable at all times, adequate for the number of people that are likely to use them, free from obstructions and slips and trips, well lit by normal or emergency escape lighting, available for access by emergency services. It's got to have final exit doors in them. And there are some guidance around final exit doors as well. So the mechanism should really be simple and single operating units. But again, you know, it depends on what you're using the building for and what it was designed for. And that's the point of a risk assessment. So that essentially is kind of like highlighting the hazards or identifying the hazards. They're the things we've got to look at. So let's go over them quickly again. So we've got ignition, considering the combination of oxygen, fuel and heat, potential ignition sources. Then we're thinking about spread. Yeah, so we're thinking about the compartmentation of the building. We're thinking, can the fire spread by convection or conduction or radiation or direct burning? Direct burning would be housekeeping. You know, these are some simple stuff, guys. Even though I have waffled on for 20 minutes now, making this really, really overcomplicated. So, you know, real simple stuff we're going to think about. So what do we look at now? We've done that. We've nailed that. Yes, got those two columns and the risk assessment absolutely nailed down. Now we've got to consider the people at risk. So who are we thinking about here? We're thinking about staff, visitors, contractors. They're the easy one. We've got the other people, our neighbours, customers, general members of public, trespassers even. You know, it's anyone that can get into your property. Don't be messaging me, man. Oh my God, health and safety got mad because even your trespasser can sue you now. Because I'm still searching. And if any of you do know of a specific case study, but other than that farmer guy that shot the geezer in the back, I'm actually searching for a case study where they've successfully sued the owner of the property. Granted, I think that they did beat the guy with the farmer that shot him in the back. I think he lost that case last I looked. But anyway, if you know, let me know, because I can't find anything. Anyway, again, we're getting off subject. Maybe we do a podcast on civil law. That would be a good one. So we're thinking about staff. Staff are lovely and easy people to manage. Well, maybe not, but they're easy from the context of fire safety because you know them, you know how able they are or are not, and in which case you can then do a PEEP. So a PEEP is a personal emergency evacuation plan, and that'd be when someone's even broken a leg and they're only temporarily disabled for a couple of months. You should take steps as the responsible person to ensure they can get out of the building. So my wife used to work in a property. She broke her leg. She worked on the first floor and they didn't do anything, yet they like to preach how good they were at health and safety, but they didn't do anything. They just left her upstairs and it took her about 20 minutes to get down the stairs. So thank God there wasn't a fire. And to be honest, most of the time she was there on her own as well, which was even more scary. But staff are nice and easy. All you've got to do is make sure that they're supervised or they communicate with you or both. Yeah, so they've become disabled, they've become hearing impaired or visually impaired or something like that. They need to inform you so that you can work with them to ensure they can get out in an emergency. There might be a wheelchair user, you know, and there are things where you can have refuges. There's lots and lots of solutions. So don't be like, oh, you can't work here anymore. We've got to change your office, change your role. There's loads and loads of things we can do. Buddy-buddy systems are nice and simple, get them into the staircase, let everybody go, and then you and the buddy could just help them down the stairs. You know, it could be a confidence thing. There's many, many things you can do. Visitors normally, again, are quite able, but still could be the fact that you might get somebody in a wheelchair, you might get someone who's hard of hearing, you might get someone who's visually impaired. You've just got to ask a question. So a simple question. Hey, welcome to the building. Please, you need to sign in here just so we know you're here, because in the event of a fire, we want you to leave the building as quick and as safe as possible and come round to the front of this car park, just out the front. You come meet me. I'm your receptionist and I'll check the names on this book and hopefully you'll be there to put your hand up and say, yes, I'm here and safe. Do you have any problems with that? Are you able to self-evacuate on your own in the off chance that you do get lost and separated from the person you're with today? The person you're with and meeting today will hopefully stay with you all the time and will escort you in the event of a fire. But obviously there are the small, slight chance that you might become on your own, say if you go to the loo or anything like that. So in that case, are you able to self-evacuate? Yes, I am. Thank you very much. Oh, great news. Hopefully you won't come to that and I'll see you at the end of the day. Have a great day. Boom, induction done. Well, maybe I should record that and you just can all just have it and just press play at your reception. Because I think all receptionists hate doing that. Yeah, so that's a simple way you can manage visitors. And then it's on your staff now to manage that visitor. So they're their visitors. So, hey, James, your visitor's here. I'll call. I'll come and get them. Hey, down. Thanks, Bob, the receptionist. Come with me, Charlie, the visitor. Charlie, just stick with me today, but in the off chance we get separated, the receptionist tell you what to do. Yeah, they did. Yeah, I'm fine. We're getting out. Cool. Your emergency exits are over there. Let's crack on and do what we're here to do. Simple stuff. other people like neighbours. Well, neighbours are, you know, neighbours is where it's basically your neighbours, but it's anyone really that you can be affected by your undertaking. So, you know, if your construction site, something like that, think about if you had quite a big fire in a construction site, about the access to that construction site and things like that. Customers, same as visitors, you know, these are all simple things to manage. So now we're getting on to evaluate, eliminate and reduce. So basically it's the same as the normal risk assessment that you would do. And we've kind of talked through it anyway. You know, we're just thinking, have you kept any sources of fuel and heat or slash sparks even? Do you keep them apart? You know, if someone wanted to start a fire deliberately, maybe, is there anything around that they could use? You know, are you securing fuel from arsonists? Things like that. Have you protected your premises from accidental fire or arson? You know, how can you make sure everyone is safe? You know, how are you making sure everyone's got out of the building in the event of a fire? So we just spoke about visitors. So your receptionist might take the visitor book out. What are your fire marshals doing? Have you got fire marshals? If you have, how are they checking the building? You know, roll calls are a bit out of date now. And actually, in my experience, they're really, really hard to manage. Admin heavy. In a lot of our organizations where we're turning over a lot of staff, I find a sweep is a lot quicker and a lot easier. You know, you've got six marshals and they're just going to, alarm goes off, right, I'm zone one, walk around zone one, knocking on every door. How are we doing? Yeah, everybody's out and there's no one in here. Hello, anyone in here? No. Hello, is anyone in here? Yes, I'm here. Oh, okay, you come with me. Okay, I'll evacuate. No, you stay with me. We'll keep going. Okay, now me and you are going to leave the building. Why do they stay with you? Well, they stay with you in case if that person gets separated and then they're still in the building. If they stay with you, when you get out, you know they're out because they're there with you. So things like that, you've got to consider. How are people going to be aware of the fire? So what detection have you got in? What alarm system have you got in? How are you warning people to get them out? How are you going to call the fire service? If it was a small fire, could you put that fire out quite quickly and do it yourself? So do you have extinguishers? If you have extinguishers, are people trained? You know, you're thinking about how to stop it spreading there, aren't we? So we're thinking about eliminating it from the start. When I worked in manufacturing, that was quite a big part of our operation because we had like explosive atmospheres. So a lot of our products that we were making produced an explosive gas. So it was the product itself was flammable as well. So, you know, we had this kind of concoction of just a fire waiting to happen. So the staff were heavily trained on kind of like emergency reaction. And I was actually in there once when a fire started. And the way these gents just operated and just kind of switched on, grabbed an extinguisher and just extinguished the whole line. And all the automatic systems kicked in and I was doors shutting everywhere and the gas had cut off and everything. It was just a slick operation, and it was all stemmed from the explosive atmospheres assessment and the fire risk assessment and the training and the management all come together to produce this one-off emergency situation. It was slick as beep. It was awesome. It was an awesome thing to watch. If you've got safety equipment, does it work? You know, can you imagine those guys picking up an extinguisher to extinguish that product in an explosive atmosphere and the extinguishers didn't work? And like we've just said, they need training, they need to know how to use this stuff. So we touched on here what I would refer to as a capsule of fire safety systems. So we mentioned like detection and alarm, you know, got to make sure that they match your evacuation. So we mentioned that there's four main types of evacuation: stay put, simultaneous, phased, and progressive horizontal. And each one has a different setup of alarms. You might have two different sounders. You might just have a domestic setup in a stay put environment. You've got to think about that as well. Bearing in mind, this stuff will be in the health and safety folder that you were given when you purchased the property, hopefully. And the off chance that it isn't, and it's your first ever fire risk assessment, and you're probably not comfortable doing it, then maybe get a good consultant to come in and do your first one so you can then review it going forward so that they can collect all the information and know that it's the right thing for the right building. That might be the best way to start. And we will touch on how to look for a good consultant in a minute. other things to think about, fire extinguishers, you know, in general, they should be just provided for specific risks around your property. And 9 times out of 10, you just find them on the final exit doors. But the general guidance, I mean, typically, if you look at the guidance, the LGA guidance, typically class A fire risk provision of one water-based extinguisher for approximately every 200 meter square floor space with a minimum of 2 extinguishers per floor. So really 2 extinguishers per floor. On average, most office blocks now have 2 exits, so you would probably just have 1 at each exit. You're probably just going to have more than that anyway. Naturally, there's normally like a powder and a water to account for the PCs and stuff like that. So it's pretty simple how to think about all this stuff. It's just kind of common sense. Emergency lighting. Where do we need emergency lighting? Again, really simple. Change of direction and change of level. Yeah, so when the level changes on your staircase, emergency lighting. When you're turning left or right, emergency lighting. Also need them 1 meter from emergency signage. So here's a trick so you don't spend loads of money. Don't put the lights near the sign, put the sign near the lights, because the signage is really cheap and the emergency lighting is really bloody expensive. So don't be an idiot and move your lights to your signs, or like I've seen, have an emergency light by a door, but then an emergency light next to a sign that we stuck to the wall about 2 meters down from the other emergency light. Like, literally. Stupidity breeds stupidity. Anyway, emergency light, real simple. Change your direction, change your level, 1 meter from signage. So put your signs within 1 meter of your emergency lights. Automatic suppression then. There's no legal requirement at the moment for automatic suppression in most cases. There are some minute cases where you will need them. A risk assessment most likely will highlight the need for automatic suppression in some cases where you might have a large ignition source or a large collection of fuel. So racking systems, they are quite commonly filled with sprinklers, and that's normally a requirement from your insurance company. So each bay in the racking, what are they called? Are they called racking? High-rise racking? I can't remember. It's been a while since I've worked in warehousing. But you know what I mean. So you might have within each kind of cell in the racking will have a sprinkler head in it. So if one pallet sets on fire, extinguishes that pallet. So the damage is, you know, minimized massively. You know, real clever systems. Other things to think about, AOVs and MOVs. So these are automatic manual opening valves. So AOV is an automatic opening valve and a MOV is a manual opening valve. So these are systems that can either be manually or automatically opened to allow smoke to leave the property. So 9 times out of 10, you're going to have these in big buildings, high-rise buildings, where you've got a large staircase as an emergency escape route. So that just keeps it nice and smoke-free for people to evacuate. Other things to consider, wet and dry risers, things like that. So these are basically piping systems that are installed in the building with an inlet on the outside for the fire service to let water into so that they don't have to carry the hose all the way upstairs. So these are systems that are provided for firefighters. All of these things need maintaining. All of these things can help you mitigate risk. So they're good to have. In some cases, they're needed. You've got to have them. But if you've got them, make sure you maintain them. So now, finally, we're going to move on to record, plan, and train. So you have to write it down. It's the same as everything. If you've got 5 or more staff, you have a license. So some places require you to have a license, and that license will require you to have a fire risk assessment. HMOs are a good example of that. A little bit of personal advice from me: if you're allowing public access to your property, I'd probably just have that written down, your fire assessment anyway. You know, once you're letting it out to the public, you can't really control the numbers you're coming in. And yes, if you have 5 more members of staff, you have to legally write it down. But if you're going to have 5 or more people in the property in addition to 2 or 3 staff, maybe it's a small shop, you could potentially have 10 in one time. It's better to just have it written down. Also, it's going to help you in any kind of civil litigation as well. So plan. We have a, you've got to have clear plans on how to prevent a fire. You've got to have plans on how to keep people safe. You've got to have emergency plans, maintenance plans of fire safety systems, plants and equipment, plan to coordinate and cooperate with other users of the building. So now we've got to think about reviews. So, you know, I've literally just absolutely blew through that. And that's kind of mainly because I waffled at the beginning about fire and got completely off subject. And now we're at 34 minutes into this already, and I've actually whizzed through the rest of it. Also because I am very aware that I've still got to peel some potatoes, make some roasties before the wife gets home, or else I will be dead and not be providing you with any more podcasts, which hopefully you'd be really upset about. So now we're going to talk about review. So basically, you've done your risk assessment because you've listened to this awesome podcast, and now you're like, oh my God, I can do a fire risk assessment. So you've nailed out your fire risk assessment. Now you've got to review it. So you need to kind of keep it under kind of really a constant review, or at least regular reviews over time. And that's basically just keeping it in the back of your head, just being mindful of any kind of changes to your property. Now, one thing to keep an eye out for: most consultants will automatically put an annual review time on your fire risk assessment. They will automatically put in there to be reviewed in 1 year, and people do it. It's pretty much a license to print money. There is not a legal requirement to review it yearly. To the episode where we went through the regulatory reform order then. So what does the law say? Basically, it says they've got to review it if there's reason to suspect it's no longer valid, or there's been significant change to the premises, to the technique, to the organisational measures, to the organisation itself, to the kind of services that you're providing, any kind of changes. Let's say you have an extension on a property, you've extended the property. Or let's say you have, I don't know, you've got double the amount of customers coming in for some reason. You know, technically it could be a change. So just keep it in the back of your head and just think about these things. So, hang on a minute, we've got double the amount of customers in. I'm just going to have a check with our escape routes just to see if it can take that amount of customers. If it can't, we might need to think about some other mitigating steps here. You know, just keep it in the back of your head. You don't have to do it annually, but you do have to just keep thinking about it. Just keep thinking about it. Anytime you change anything in your business, that risk assessment becomes no longer valid, and you just think, all right, boom, I need to go and review that now. You might not even have to rewrite it, just have to change a little bit. If you're going to do a kind of annual kind of check, then I wouldn't rewrite the whole thing. Just have like a little box on the fire risk assessment or a separate form or something like that that you can just go to, sign, say, yep, I've checked it and nothing's changed. So finally, who can do a fire risk assessment then? So interestingly, here's a guide from, here's what the Fire Risk Assessment Competency Council says in their guide. There is no legislative requirement for fire risk assessments to be carried out by a competent person. Interesting. This is to avoid any implication that every duty holder under the legislation, which and also the responsible person, needs to employ the services of a fire safety specialist, such as a consultant, to carry out their fire risk assessments. For small, simple premises, it's often the duty holder that carries out the fire risk assessment, and arguably, in these premises, the duty holder is the best person to do so because of their intimate knowledge of the premises and the activities therein. Guidance to support those wishing to carry out fire assessment themselves has been made available by the government. There you go, guys. You've heard it from the top of the top. These people that are in this Fire Assessment Competency Council are the top dogs of fire. All of the collections of the institutes and all the you know, old bods that sitting at the top, they said that and they put it in there. So don't you take that consultant's word for gospel, because he's having you on and he's full of crap because he wants to pay for his new Ferrari. So you can do it yourself, but it can be quite daunting, and I can completely understand that. For some buildings, it can get quite complicated. So for small buildings, small pubs and restaurants even, you know, small shops and offices. Our FRA can be really, really simple. When the properties start to get bigger, or the ignition source is starting to get bigger, or your collection of fuel starts to get bigger, you know, or the nature of the building or the people starts to get more complicated, maybe you get multiple organizations in one building, there's a sleeping risk. Now we're starting to talk about quite complicated things here. Now you may want to hire a consultant. So in that case, the reference that we've just spoken about, the guide from the Fire Risk Assessment Competency Council, which I will link to in the description for you, that can help you massively because that breaks down what a competent fire risk assessor actually looks like. Not looks like, you know, must have a beard, must have good hair, must be really good looking, really good fashion self. I'm going to stop describing myself now. Yeah, that's awkward. Nope, even my dog didn't find that funny. And he normally laughs at everything. So you've got that guide. You've got that Fire Risk Assessment Competency Council guide. What else have we got? What else can we consider? Well, there's institutes. You can look out for some members of institutes, such as the Institute of Fire Engineers. There are other institutes, such as the Institute of Fire Safety Managers. They're all good, you know. Don't take them for automatic evidence of competency. There's some little tricks that some people do. Let's take this, and I'm being brutally honest here. The IFE, the Institute of Fire Engineers, normally holds their members to a higher standard than others, such as the Institute of Fire Safety Managers. So a technician in an IFE is quite a competent person. Normally, and again, don't take that for gospel, whereas an associate, which is the next level up, in the Institute of Fire Safety Managers, is equivalent to a technician in the IFE. So just bear that in mind. So the easy thing to do, I would start, that's your base, that's what I would do, that's your base limit. Employ fire safety consultants and fire risk assessors as a minimum that are technicians in the IFE or equivalent. Yeah. So then what else do we do? Well, now we can start looking into the Fire Risk Assessment Competency Council guide. We can also think about things like accreditation or registers that you can get onto the Register of Fire Risk Assessors. So a registered fire risk assessor might start to become law in the future. There's a lot of chat around that. Whether that will happen, I don't know. Whether that's a good thing or not, I'm a bit on the fence. I think they would probably need to tighten up the registers. There's a lot of them. Probably each of the membership kind of groups have their own register. And then there's other ones, you know, BAFE do one, Warrington Fire do one. There's a lot out there. Are they all the same? Do they all hold them to the same standards? It's just, they're just too much to measure. So I think that needs tightening up before they make it law. Anyway, again, yet again, I am waffling. So the simple things you can do is you can ask these people about their experiences. You know, ask them about the problems you got on fire. What do they think about? What would they do? Ask them if they've got any testimonials, any case studies. Try and find their customers on social media. LinkedIn's a great place for that. Hey, anyone, have you used bloody blah fire risk assessments? Also, one final kind of note, don't take a history of working in a fire service and automatic signed for competency either. You know, that sounds really horrible, and I'm no disrespect to the fire service, believe me, I'm a massive advocate for them. I was absolutely fuming when I watched that dispatcher show. Again, I am waffling. I'm just not going to do a fire podcast again because obviously I just cannot shut up. Anyway, to the point, don't take history of working in a fire service and an automatic sign for competency either. You know, try and find out if they were operational or whether they worked in fire safety. They're two very different things. Operational is the people that save your life. Fire safety, the people stop the need for operational. They're the people that are like checking the buildings, the inspectors that come around, people that are like going around trying to be a bit more preemptive, checking building designs, things like that. They are the fire safety department. Most of the cases, they work together enforcement as well. I think London has a separate enforcement unit. But anyway, I am not here trying to moan about consultants. They have a place and they will help you. And there are some awesome, awesome consultants out there that really, really know their shit. I'm just trying to help you weed out the cowboys. Check the consultant's advice on their website as well and check that against the law. You know, remember when I told you in episode 7 about that consultant that was saying that it's against the law for you to do a fire assessment yourself? They're lying. You know, for me, that's a big no-no. See you later. Boom, you're not hiring you. And we've just mentioned the fire risk assessor's register. So, I mean, if you're having all these conversations, you're looking at all this stuff, you're going to find a good consultant, or you're at least reducing your chances of getting a crap consultant. So I have absolutely whizzed over that stuff, guys. But that is in 45 minutes-ish, that is how to do a fire risk assessment. You know, basic stuff. It's not too hard. I will put a link to the description of kind of good guides and things like that. I will link to all the other stuff I've mentioned as well. The competency criteria for fire assessors by the council. I hope you found this useful, guys. So let me know if you do your own fire risk assessments, if you do, how you found them. If you went on any training as well, whack it on the comments on LinkedIn or something like that so people can see it and you can help out the community as well. So don't forget, hit us up on Twitter at RiskFluent or come find us on Facebook / RiskFluent. I'm James McPherson. You can find me on LinkedIn as well. Hey, if you're listening on Google or Apple or Spotify, give us some stars, give us a share. A review would be absolutely awesome. So, yeah, thanks for listening, guys. I'll see you next week.